The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
What would you like for breakfast?
The usual.
The usual coming up. Milk, cereal,
and some bacon.
Bacon.
And one soft-boiled egg.
And one soft-boiled egg.
Thanks, Mom.
A clip there from The Jetsons, the classic cartoon that imagined a future when kitchens would be obsolete and robots do the cooking. Sounds like a fantasy, right? Well,
this is the Molly Robotic Kitchen, a unique fusion of cutting-edge technology and human expertise. Designed to fit into a regular kitchen, it can cook any dish from anywhere in the world. The Molly Robotic Kitchen makes having freshly prepared meals an everyday reality.
The Molly Robotic Kitchen was unveiled at an industry fair last year. Beyond the basics, its makers claim that it makes a mean crab bisque and hope to have it on the market by 2017. Cooking robots are one of many ways that technology is altering food production. That's a scary combination for many people who may find the idea of 3D printed cookies and lab-grown hamburgers intriguing, but doubt the profit motives and methods of big ag and industrialized food. But Jason Lusk is downright excited. He's an agricultural economist at Oklahoma State who argues that confronting global hunger, obesity, and climate change without abusing animals or degrading the environment requires technological and biological innovation and entrepreneurial thinking. He's author of Unnaturally Delicious, How Science and Technology Are Serving Up Superfoods to Save the World. And we reached him via Skype. Jason, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
So we started with this clip from The Jetsons. How do you imagine the kitchens of the future, say 20, 50 years from now? Is there going to be a robo-chef in every home?
That clip was awesome. I haven't heard that one before. I don't think, you know, we'll probably ever get quite to that point or, you know, to the Star Trek food replicator. But we're taking small steps in that direction. And this, robotic kitchen that Molly Robotics has come up with is one really interesting idea. The way that works is they put sensors on the arms and hands of chefs, some of them celebrity chefs, and it records all their movements while they're making a dish. So it would be really like having your favorite celebrity chef in your own kitchen. And I think that's awesome. You know, there is probably a tendency for people to say, well, what about cooking? Shouldn't we be encouraging people to get back in the kitchen and cook? And there's some things to be said for that. I like to cook, but I like to do it on my own terms and when I want to do it. And so, you know, if we look back at our history, cooking and cleaning every day, day in and day out, was a bit of a drudgery. And if you look at these time use surveys and they measure how people spend their time, American women were spending about 60% more time in meal preparation, about 100% more time in meal cleanup about 60 years ago than they do today. And so, you know, all the modern innovations we've had that we've welcomed into our kitchen have really made life a lot easier for us and in many dimensions have improved our quality of life.
Domestic production aside, you write about a lot of different technologies in this book, running the gamut from farm to table to lab. Can you pick one of the biggest, most potentially game-changing innovations that you chose for your book?
I'll pick one just because it's an example close to home, and it does tell you sometimes some of the most amazing stuff that's happening is going on right under your nose. So people are often concerned these days about large farms and about, you know, nitrogen runoff from these farms getting in our waterways and these sorts of things. But I think most people that are out there scarcely can imagine the complication of running large-scale family farms these days. And one company that I talked to, SST Software, they're basically a big data company, and they're making use of all this data that farmers are now collecting. A lot of it is through yield monitors. As farmers go through their fields and harvest their crop, they're measuring the amount of output they get per acre of land. And what they can do is combine that information with soil moisture, with soil types. And the idea is both that that by being much more precise, by harnessing this power of big data, that not only can we get more food per acre of land, so that means food's going to be less expensive, it also means that we could be more judicious about our use of herbicides and even pesticides if we know which areas of the field are more prone to pests, that we can cut back on those in certain areas and eliminate the runoff into our waterways. So this is an example of technology use on the farm that's having benefits for food consumers, farmers, and also the environment right now underneath our noses. And yet most people have really no idea that this is happening on most big farms.
Nor did I. It really surprised me, some of the stats that you had about how American agricultural has kept up with population growth through these technological innovations. Give us a little sense of that in the past, 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, so one really amazing thing is that today we've got less land in production today than we did in the 1950s. But amazingly, we're getting over 100% more food on smaller amounts of land. So I think somehow in these discussions we've had about sustainability, for example, we've taken this idea of sustainability to mean somehow it has to be small, it has to be local, it has to be organic. There's nothing wrong with those things. But one of the things I'm encouraging people to do with this book is to also not forget the fact that productivity enhancing technologies are a key component of sustainability. If we can use technologies that get us more food, better food, using less land, less pesticides, less herbicides, that is, to me, the definition of sustainability.
We recently did a segment about eggs where we talked about the differences between cage-free and conventional eggs. You have an example in your book, or you write, that there may be a middle ground that is better for both humans and the chickens, and animal cruelty is a big concern.
It is. I think people are rightfully concerned about animal welfare. The challenge, though, is are finding smart ways to do it in a way that's both beneficial for the animal and for the people buying those eggs. And unfortunately, cage-free is not what a lot of people think it is. There are some advantages to cage-free systems. Birds get more room and they can exhibit some natural behaviors like dust bathing, scratching on the ground. But it's not the paradise some people think it is. So big, crowded, dusty, smelly places can be higher death rates in those kind of systems. Birds tend to peck on each other. So pecking order is a real life phenomenon. And so one innovation, a technological solution to this problem was come up with by some animal welfare researchers in Europe, and they created what they call an enriched colony cage. And it's just a big cage. It's much larger than these small battery cages that a lot of hens are in. So the birds have a lot more room. They also have perches. They also have some areas where they can scratch around, and they have a nesting area. The hens like to lay their eggs in a secluded area, so they go back there and do that. And so, it's not a paradise. It's not a Ritz-Carlton or anything like that, but it is an innovative compromise that attempts to combine some of the advantages of that barn system in a way that aren't too costly for the food consumer, and also in a way that eliminates some of the problems that we see in those open barn systems that come with pecking and with high death rates.
Lab-grown hamburgers, robotic chefs, farm drones. Well, we're talking about the future, and in these cases, the present of food production, with Jason Lusk. He's author of Unnaturally Delicious. It's a book about how science and technology are serving up superfoods, as he puts it, to save the world. But there is a tension between that need for more efficient forms of food production and, as you mentioned, the kind of cultural ideas around food. If you ask many people about increasing farm yield, it feels like a double-edged sword. Yes, production, affordability up, that's great. But what is being grown? How it's being grown? For whom? And at what cost to the environment and our health?
Yeah, I mean, these are all legitimate concerns. And you're right. Most people, if you increase farm yields, the average food consumer is going to say, so what? I mean, it does have a benefit because it, on the margin, lowers prices that consumers face in the grocery store. But it's kind of hard for people to see that benefit. One of the things I try to point out is that there's a lot of innovation going on there, it's not just focused on productivity per se, but also in improving the quality of food, the nutrition of foodstuffs, the accessibility of food. So I talk about new crop varieties that are higher in nutrient content. Often these are efforts focused on the developing world, breeding new crop varieties that are higher in micronutrients, whether it's vitamin A or vitamin D or even in iron. So these are parts of the world that consumers suffer from malnutrition and a lot of other maladies. And so again, here's an example where science can provide crops to these people. These people tend to rely on a single staple crop for a lot of their nutritional needs in a way that not only gives them calories, increases yields, but also gives them better quality food. These aren't some big corporate conglomerates that are doing this. These tend to be small startup companies, nonprofits in a lot of cases, and sometimes even government organizations trying to help their own citizens. So it's not the case that only big agrochemical companies are trying to introduce new food and agricultural technologies. I give a lot of examples in the book of small companies, of entrepreneurs, and even of students out there doing all kinds of creative stuff that will hopefully improve not only the quantity of food, but also the quality.
One of the places you point out where this kind of double-edged sword or double standard about food comes up is in the production and the, let's say, maligning of pink slime, as they call it, which, how could you help but malign pink slime?
Well, that, it sounds terrible, just the word, right? And so the way most people heard about this story was through a series of media stories that broke, and it fit a narrative that has been created about food that's sort of like the jungle. There's big, bad meat packers doing things to your food that you don't know anything about, and they're just, trying to cut corners to make money while reducing the health of food products. But I think if you just step back a little bit and find out about the sort of truth behind the story, see a much more complex story. And in particular, I think it's a story about food waste. The man who started the company who created the so-called pink slime, it's called lean, finely textured beef, he was interested in saving resources. He saw this meat that was going to less productive uses, and he created a process to pull protein out of big meat cuts that would otherwise be eaten. And so this is the same protein, for example, that would be used in your hamburger. It just wasn't economical to pay a worker to cut it out with their knife. And so he created a process where he could pull this protein out, and we could put it back into our hamburger. So it's, again, the same protein you'd have in a hamburger anyway. Not only that, it was successful in creating ground meat that was lower in fat content. So people that were concerned about fat, here's a way they could get a less expensive, lower fat product in a way that cut down on the amount of animals that we need to produce our food supply. So one estimate suggests that his process was equivalent to saving about 5,000 cows a day. And yet the story most people were told and that they remember is one about this ooey, icky stuff that might be in their hamburger. But by the way, if you Google the word pink slime, the image that you see is almost certainly not the product that was in your hamburger. Actually, most of the people I've talked to in the food industry have no idea what that particular image is of. And so I think this is just an unfortunate situation where we let a narrative get in the way of the facts.
Well, I think it's that people don't trust companies. I mean, that's part of it. And you're pointing out that this is not all corporate greed that's driving this. But I'm thinking that throughout history, not all food innovations have been good ones. I mean, we used to put chalk in our bread, lead in wine and beer, for example. So given that history, there's a lot of reason for mistrust. Shouldn't we be cautious with innovation in food production?
Sure. I'm not necessarily saying we got to take every new technology that comes along on blind faith. I don't think that would be responsible either. But what I think we do want to do is look at what the best science has to say about whether technologies are safe to use. And I think in a lot of cases, there's a really wide gulf between sort of what the average scientist thinks about something like, say, biotechnology, GMOs, and what the average, consumer thinks on these issues. And so that sort of gulf between what we think we know scientifically and sort of what the average person feels, that's not some big corporation deceiving consumers. That's, in my assessment, a lack of understanding about the science that's being used. And I think we need to be really careful when we say, well, what we need to do is have a huge host of big regulations to make sure that all our new food innovations are safe. Because one of the things that happens when we create that huge regulatory environment is that creates a barrier to entry. It's hard for a new entrepreneur to enter the market when they have to have teams of lawyers to be able to navigate the regulatory process. So I guess what I'm saying is we need a balance. Yeah, we might want some skepticism. We might want some level of oversight and regulation, but that we can also over-regulate. We can also keep a lot of really productive and interesting and small companies from the market if we become too cautious.
Funny that those are exactly the kind of companies we tend to celebrate, but still people have a more homespun concept of food at the user end. A relationship that is very different than we have with our phones or other gadgets. Is that a hoop that people can jump through?
Possibly. I mean, we have embraced a lot of new food technologies. We just don't realize we've done it. So if you walked in a kitchen from 100 years ago, it would probably be foreign to most of us. If you walked in a kitchen of 1,000 years ago, we probably wouldn't even recognize a lot of the foods we were eating. So we've been evolving with the food around us, and even our own kitchens have been evolving in the way that we use the kitchens and modern devices, whether it's refrigerators or microwaves or blenders or mixers. All of those things are relatively new innovations. So I don't think it's necessarily true that over the long run that people don't like food and agricultural change and technology. I think it's just one where sometimes people are a little more cautious sometimes when it comes to food. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but we want to also be responsible with that caution.
Jason Lusk, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Jason Lusk, he's author of Unnaturally Delicious, How Science and Technology Are Serving Up Superfoods to Save the World. He's also an agricultural economist at the University of Oklahoma. More on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Innovations in agriculture may be key to feeding the future, but there are still some food traditions that rely on small harvests and childhood memories to stay alive. Producer Guy Hand has the story of one such fruit, the quince.
Modern science acknowledges the unique power of taste and aroma to teleport us back in time. It's simply the way our brains are wired. For Boise and Dave Turner, quince was the catalyst that shot him back in time.
As a youngster, somewhere between 6 and 10, I'm remembering, my grandmother used to make this quince jelly. You know, I never knew what a quince was. She called it quince jelly, and it was all I knew it was, in my mind, were the most marvelous tasting jellies I'd ever had.
An apple-like fruit that Puritan settlers brought to America in 1629, the quince thrived in colonial communities and eventually made it all the way to Idaho, where Turner's grandmother made her jelly. But as Turner grew up, he forgot about quince until that memory came back.
Somewhere in my 30s, I kind of was thinking back about how wonderful that jelly was and wondered if I could get some. And I looked around, you couldn't buy it. And nobody even knew what it was.
Quince had long been prized for its unique flavor and as an irreplaceable source of pectin, which is used to set and thicken jams and jellies. But once artificial pectin was developed in the mid-20th century, quince quickly disappeared from American kitchens.
So I started hunting around the Treasure Valley, calling and going to different nurseries looking for a quince tree. And they pretty much thought I was nuts.
Turner looked for a couple of years. Then one day a nursery called with good news.
And he says, I've got three trees in, and they are very good-looking trees. And I said, great. So I took the afternoon off, and I ripped over there, and I bought two of the three trees, and they're the ones that I have now. Over here, I'll pick one.
On this late fall afternoon, Turner introduces me to those trees, now 25 years old and full of fruit.
Come in here.
Mm.
And you can kind of smell them.
Kind of
smell
great.
Them under the canopy of the tree here.
The scent reminds me of pear, lemon, honey, and nutmeg.
The tree looks much like an apple tree, except that the fruit's kind of a strange fruit. It's shaped, in my mind, shaped more like a pomegranate because they're lumpy and color of a golden delicious, except that they have a little bit of green on them and they have a wax with fuzz on the outside.
Some biblical scholars suggest the quince was the Garden of Eden's true forbidden fruit. Homer and Virgil waxed poetic about its virtues, and ancient Greeks used the ripe, aromatic fruit as air fresheners. The Spanish made a quince paste called membrillo, which Idaho's Bass community still enjoys today. Turner says his quince trees have attracted new fans.
I have a pretty good following of people, so I don't have any trouble getting rid of the fruit. Those people that do know what quince are really seek them. They're hooked on them like I am.
But did Turner's quest for quince live up to his childhood memories?
Once I got fruit and made this jelly using Grandma's recipe, it was, in fact, that flavor come right back. It just took me way back to when I was 6 or 7 years old. It was the smell and the taste that I was looking for.
And right then, Turner realized quince was not only a favorite food, but an edible path to the past.
And our thanks to producer Guy Hand for that piece.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Roy Blunt Jr. grew up in the South, which means he was eating pork belly back when butchery was not considered glamorous, and chowing on chicken gizzards long before anyone dreamed that a chef would admit to cooking with organ meats, never mind beyond TV. The frequent Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist is neither highbrow in his love of food nor language. Witness this little nugget from an appreciation of a frequently maligned condiment.
Truer words were never uttered. Anything good is better buttered.
That is one of many homespun odes to deliciousness from Save Room for Pie, Food Songs, and Chewy Ruminations, which is what, Roy, your 24th book?
That's right, Virginia, number 24.
Well, I'm so glad to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you write, where I come from, the worst thing you can be is persnickety, which means you're not afraid of eating what kinds of food that other people consider scary.
Well, you mentioned organ meats, that is, say, organic organ meats, and you mentioned, well, there's okra, of course, and lots of things, like butter, that people have eschewed now seems to be good for us, from what I'm reading. And as soon as I hear that something is good for us again, I tend to go that way. And if I hear that something is bad for us, I say, let's not rush to judgment.
Anything that you won't eat?
Well, I mean, I don't like Japanese red bean desserts for some reason. When they grind up red beans and turn them into odd pastries. Somehow that has never, it just don't seem right to me. But maybe I'll learn, because I believe in in acquired tastes. If I had not ever acquired any tastes, I would be very limited indeed.
I remember in the book you writing about foam as something you would resist.
That's true. I might not know whether I have eaten it or not, because it just seems to be a ridiculous form of food. Anybody who reduces bacon or mushrooms to just foam is crazy. I mean, half the delight of bacon and mushrooms is the texture and the chew feel.
Well, hence the chewy ruminations from the subtitle.
Right.
You gotta
right.
chew. Well, you and food clearly get along very well. And I know public radio listeners have heard you plenty, but maybe not seen you. You don't look like a guy who overindulges a lot in food. Is there a secret to that?
Well, I got sciatica a few months ago, and didn't get much sleep, and somehow or another I lost a lot of weight. I don't recommend that diet plan, but I tend to get a little paunchy, I'll admit it. But I'd rather be paunchy than deprive myself of perfectly good food. There are some guidelines. For instance, if a food sounds like a poo sharp, like natural fats, it's probably good for you. If it sounds like something sort of sadomasochistic, like whipped spread, it is not good for you.
Also in your guidelines, eat as much gravy as you want, and of course, save room for pie.
Save room for pie. Yeah, that's the theme of the book, is save room for pie. It is a guideline, because we all know that the first three French fries are the best ones. They're the real good ones that you deserve. But after that, you're just eating them because they're there and they're not as good. And there are two ways to stop doing that. You can either say, okay, just stuff your face. You're just going to get fat on these French fries. Just go ahead and do it. In which case, you will lose respect for yourself. Or you can say to yourself, let's save room for pie. And even if you don't wind up eating any pie, you're thinking about pie, and you don't need to eat extra French fries.
So how about all the advice we get on avoiding fats and sugar and eating for health? What's your opinion on eating healthy?
I think you should bear health in mind, but eating just purely for health is like marrying for money. It's not crazy. I mean, there's some logic to it, but unless there's an element of yum there, neither marriage nor eating is going to work.
And obviously you like to tuck into a good-sized steak. What to you is a good-sized steak?
Once I went to Canyon Ranch, it was with a health spa place, once mm-hmm. to write a story about it, and I was served a steak that it was a poignant little steak. It was about the size of my thumb, and I felt protective toward it, really. I like a steak that's big enough to sort of wrestle with it. It doesn't have to be huge, but there's something about a steak that wants to be slightly bigger than you really want to eat. Now, and steak is something that I do not say save room for pie during. I don't know. Maybe I'm inconsistent.
Well, you may recognize that voice as Roy Blunt, Jr. He's a frequent panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's also an author of many, many books, and his journalism experience is vast and fascinating. The newest book is called Save Room for Pie, Food Songs and Chewy Ruminations. But on the subject of steak, you make clear that your wife is very concerned about, first of all, eating healthy, eating organic, and eating food that is good for the planet. How do you manage that?
Well, it's something that's the new challenge of eating today is to eat in such a way that you won't contribute to the melting of the polar ice cap and eating in such a way that the animals you eat have had some sort of life before you eat them. So we eat grass-fed, not just grass-fed beef, but grass-finished beef.
What does that mean?
Lots of so-called grass-fed beef they've been fed grass-fed until the last week or so when they're rushed off to one of those places where they're stuffed on, they're rushed off to a corn lot where they're stuffed with quick carbohydrates and fattened up. So you need cows that have had a nice grazing life. And so then you can feel, there are all sorts of other environmental issues with regard to meat, obviously, but I just can't do without meat. I wrote a little poem about it. It's called I Like Meat. Cold meat and hot meat, sliced thick or thin. I guess I've just got meat under my skin. Pardon while I recite my own verse.
I really appreciate you doing it. Well, you grew up in the South, now live part-time in the South and also in Western Mass. But yeah, you resist comparing how people eat in the North and South. Why is that?
Well, I've got a long piece in the book, which is the kind of large family eating scene that I grew up with, of people eating lots of the food and just pushing themselves to the point of eating as much as they possibly can and also talking about it while they do it. It's set in the South, and it's kind of a Southern accent, all they talk, but I've read that scene in front of audiences for all over the country, and people come up from Italian families and Midwestern families of all kinds, and they come up and say, that's not just Southern, that's the way we used to talk when we ate when I was a kid.
It is a substantial little section of the book. So many different expressions for, boy, I've eaten too much. But would you like to share any of that with us?
All right, I'll read you some from this piece called The Way Folks Are Meant to Eat. And us to thy service, I'm in. Pitch in. I don't know where to start first. Big Mama has outdone herself tonight. Well, I just hope y'all can enjoy it. I believe I could eat a horse.
Would you look at them tomatoes?
Ooh, don't they look good?
Now, Tatum, slow down. You let that child enjoy himself. Well, you think we didn't feed him at home? He didn't get any snap beans. Lord, pass that child some snap beans. Lila, how about you over there? You need something more. Butter beans. Ooh, land. No, I'm working on this corn. Come on, just a dab. Well, you talked me into it. Awful early to be getting this good of corn. Eunice, would you send that Oakley back around? Look at me, just a-putting it away. I'm eating like a field hand. A little more tea to wash it down. These greens. It goes on like that for quite a while.
I think Roy Blunt Jr., you know, listening to that, I just think, is the best thing you can say at a table.
Yeah, it says it all.
Well, I thank you for speaking with us and reading for us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Roy Blunt Jr., he is the author now of 24 books and, of course, a frequent Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist. There's more in his book, Save Room for Pie, Food Songs and Chewy Ruminations at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fashion devotees and industry insiders log loads of air miles, jetting to Paris, Milan, Rio, and other swank places, sometimes several times a year. About 100,000 of the fashion hordes descend onto New York City during Fashion Week alone, shoving their designer luggage into the overhead while the rest of us schlubs shuffle onto the plane in sweatpants. Etihad Airlines is looking to tap into the game and is sponsoring 17 major fashion events around the world in hopes of becoming the Fashionista's official airline. With the global fashion industry bringing in an estimated $1.2 trillion annually, it's easy to see why Etihad is looking for a place on that other runway. Vanessa Friedman is fashion director and chief fashion critic at the New York Times. That's where she wrote about airlines embracing the fashion industry as its next big opportunity. Vanessa Friedman, great to have you with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So Etihad has not been the go-to airline for people in fashion. What other commercial airlines get the majority of business from the fashion industry?
You know, it's very straightforward. You know, if you look at the kind of fashion circuit, the twice-a-year fashion circuit that goes from New York to London to Milan to Paris, you know, it's the usual suspects. So it's American Airlines, British Airways, Air France, Alitalia, Delta, if you would.
So Etihad is looking at this as an opportunity. Why them? Why now?
Well, I think they have become the first official sponsor of Fashion Week. They're working with WME-IMG, which is, you know, the entertainment behemoth that owns 30 different fashion events around the year or operates them. And that includes New York Fashion Week, Milan Fashion Week, London Fashion Week, Berlin Fashion Week, Mumbai Fashion Week, Sydney Fashion Week, and so on. And this, you know, gives them a connection to the fashion world that hasn't really existed before between the worlds of airlines and style.
So this is a business that is really seeing this as a market that it can gain something out of. Beyond the money, what do they get in terms of prestige for carrying fashionistas?
Well, you know, one of the stranger developments over the last decade or so has been the increasing deglamorization of air travel. You know, it's become really a bunch of tin sardine cans that everyone has jammed in. And, you know, with the rise of the budget airlines like JetBlue, you know, that has been the kind of dominant trend in air travel. And I think increasingly people sort of miss the old days when it was considered, you know, fashionable to get on the airplane and cool and chic. And that's why you get these endless paparazzi pictures of Victoria Beckham going through an airport or, you know, Rita Ora going through an airport because they look sort of fabulous and people want that again. And Etihad, I think, has realized this is an opportunity to, you know, brand themselves, to give themselves a kind of halo of style, which will draw, you know, a new consumer base.
It's one thing to be fashion's preferred airline, but what does that actually mean in terms of in-flight service or perks?
I think that's all to be seen at the moment. Some of the things that they were talking about was, you know, designer toiletry bags, you know, presumably new air host outfits. I would think, different kinds of fashion TV on the entertainment system. You know, one of the initiatives that WME and IMG have started is a made-to-order channel called M2M, made-to-measure, that is a full-time fashion channel. And Etihad will actually be broadcasting this or offering this as part of their package. You know, they could live stream fashion shows. And, you know, at some point in the future, maybe you could even click on a dress on a show, order it, and, you know, get it sent to your house.
In addition to glamorizing flight, it seems like there are a lot more people interested in looking at those photos of Victoria Beckham or Angelina Jolie getting off a plane in L.A. or someplace else. What is this investment in being associated with fashion and luxury? Is this part of Etihad's strategy?
You know, I think fashion has become a kind of a go-to sector for, you know, everyone, be it a celebrity, a pop culture figure, a politician, and a consumer on the street. You know, everybody wants a part of this industry. And it is why you see the day after the Met Ball, 25 million page views on Vogue.com, people looking at the red carpet. You know, there is just a fascination with fashion, with its characters, with what it makes. And, you know, if Etihad can tap into that, that is, you know, potentially a huge market for them on all economic levels.
We did recently speak with your colleague Nelson Schwartz about the increasing velvet rope economy, meaning people and companies really going for that luxury market, the one percenters, or I guess in the fashion industry, it would be 0%, at least for fat content, is my guess. But is this the same thing, going for a separate, better experience for more better-looking, richer people?
You know, I would say it's a separate, better experience for everyone, ideally. You know, I don't think this is a velvet rope situation. I think it is a kind of polishing up or a glossing up of a brand. They have an economy class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. It's not that anyone can get on the airplane.
Right.
You know, I think they're hoping it works for them on all levels.
But you probably wouldn't want to be wearing your sweatpants.
Only if they were a designer.
Vanessa Friedman, thank you for speaking with us.
Nice to talk to you.
Vanessa Friedman, she's fashion director and chief fashion critic at the New York Times, and she wrote about airlines embracing the fashion industry as a next big opportunity. You'll find a link to read the article, wordofmouthradio.org. The next frontier in high-end travel is space. Getting humans off planet Earth is one hurdle. The other is supporting life once we leave its atmosphere. With the cost of transporting materials from Earth to space currently at $10,000 per pound, companies are now scrambling for a cost-saving solution. Producer Audrey Quinn visited a company that's trying to find a way to support life in space by extracting water and mineral from asteroids.
The way we've been doing space travel, it makes space really expensive.
If you were to go outside right now and pick up a handful of dirt, a pound of dirt, that dirt in space would be worth $10,000.
That's Rick Tumlinson. He's chair of Deep Space Industries. It's one of the companies that wants to mine asteroids. That $10,000 price tag, that's how much it costs to send a pound of anything into space.
Nothing done with it at all, just a handful of dirt. If you put it in a rocket and you flew it into space, it would be worth $10,000.
Tumlinson wants to see more people go to space. He wants to see space colonization. And he looks the part of a space-age cowboy. Cowboy boots, beard and ponytail, and a wireless headset glued to the side of his face. He says at some point soon in space travel, we're going to have to stop relying on resources from Earth.
If you're going to turn space into a frontier where human beings actually live, where the human race expands, you need to be able to live off the land.
And what space offers us is asteroids. But could asteroids really hold that much useful stuff, enough to live off of?
I was about to say all minerals that we find here would be found in an asteroid. That's not quite true. But all elements that combine to make the minerals in the asteroids are the same elements that form the Earth.
That's NASA planetary scientist Dr. Lucy McFadden. She says asteroids are made up of the same things Earth is made up of. Iron and magnesium, silicates, carbon dioxide, even some diamond. And it looks like some asteroids even have a good amount of water. Rick Tumlinson says Deep Space Industries will start small, with near-Earth test missions.
Okay, you want to see the flight hardware?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right, let's do that next.
We're going to go walk
down to the other lab.
That's Dr. Glenn Lightsey. He runs the Texas Spacecraft Lab at the University of Texas. They're a partner of Deep Space Industries.
So if I asked you to say what you thought a satellite looked like, what would you say? Something really big?
Yeah, I would imagine at least the size of like a small airplane.
Right. What if I told you you could hold a satellite in your hand?
He points to the lab bench.
This is a complete satellite. In fact,
oh,
we
wow.
can build them smaller than this.
You know what this is the size of? It's the size of a Jenga game.
Yes, yes, that's right. And hopefully it doesn't fall down.
The satellite looks like something you'd make with an erector set. A simple metal frame with scaffolding, a bunch of colorful wires. Lightsey says they're so cheap and easy to make, his students, undergrads even, have sent their own spacecraft into orbit. Miniature satellites like these, they'll be the platform for Deep Space Industries test missions for next year. Rick Tomlinson's visiting the lab.
Yeah. Yes.
You guys built this with your own hand?
Yep. Yes. Yeah.
He gathers Glenn Lightsey's crew around a lab table. It's the first time they're hearing the plans for next year's test flight.
The first spacecraft that we're going to be putting up is basically just like this.
He points to their satellite. He says Deep Space Industries will stick a grabber tool in the end and send it out with a drone. They'll get to practice grabbing and releasing the drone in space, as practice for grabbing rocks on asteroids. The company wants to fund early projects with corporate sponsorships. Imagine a spacecraft going up into the atmosphere with the logo for Monster Energy Drink or Facebook plastered on the side. And sure, there could someday be money made from precious metals on asteroids. But at this point, Deep Space Industries is largely focused on mining water.
Water is hydrogen and oxygen. If we have hydrogen and oxygen, we have air to breathe, we have water to drink, and if you light those two together, you get rocket propellant.
Tomlinson says asteroids could be fueling stations. Get your gas, your air, your water, all on the way to your interplanetary destination. Deep Space Industries also wants to get minerals out of asteroids, using heat and extreme pressure. Old school processes like molds and iron smelting, that'll turn the minerals into structures and scaffolding. And 3D printers can churn out spare parts. But just taking these resources, making money off of them, is all this legal? Who owns asteroids?
Nobody owns asteroids. The Outer Space Treaty is clear on that.
That's Rosanna Sattler. She's a lawyer in Boston with a specialty in space law. She's talking about the treaty signed by Russia, the UK, and the US in 1967. It's all about making outer space free for exploration and quote-unquote use.
The issue is, what do you do with the natural resources? Does that count as owning property? Or once you extract them, can you make the argument that we could take them away, get money for them? That's really what all the shooting is about.
So it's kind of the Wild West right now.
Once you get the private companies that actually have the ability to go to these places, and it becomes more of a reality, that's when I think you're going to see the legislation.
Deep Space Industries wants to send its grabber technology out to actual asteroids by 2017. Most asteroids are hundreds of millions of miles away, so it would be about 2019 when the spacecraft came back with asteroid samples. And by the early 2020s, the company wants to start making things on asteroids, using asteroid materials.
I'm old enough to be practical about it.
That's NASA planetary scientist Lucy McFadden again.
And it seems like it would be an awfully long time before we can actually do that.
She says there are serious engineering challenges, dealing with the cold temperatures and lower pressure conditions of space, the zero gravity.
I don't mean to be negative about it. I'm sure that maybe my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren may someday hear about it, but I think it's probably a long way away.
But Deep Space Industries already has two contracts with NASA. Virgin Galactic has the first commercial space flight scheduled for next year, and SpaceX has announced it will have a livable colony on Mars by 2026. The science fiction-y aspect of asteroid mining, the part where it assumes humans are headed for space, that's starting to look like less of a fantasy. In Austin, Texas, I'm Audrey Quinn.
And that story is part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. It's time for us to jet on out of here today, but we do invite you to share what you heard with others. Go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of segments to listen to post on social media, or to email to friends. And let us know what you're curious about, the stories and sources you find interesting, or what's scratching at your sense of wonder. We find that the best stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hope to catch up with yours. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.